Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Live from My Drum Room. I know you've been waiting for this one. This is part two of Remembering Freddie Gruber. Thanks to everybody who watched part one. And if you haven't seen part one, I strongly recommend that you do. And I will put the link in the description. I want to thank everybody who watched the entire show live. We did almost a 2.5 hour episode on April 15th, 2024, that was viewed by over 8,000 people around the world. Not surprisingly, I had an incredible group of legendary drummers and friends joining me. And many of those same legendary drummers are still here for part two. And they are Jim Keltner, Steve Smith, Dave Weckl, Adam Nussbaum, Bruce Becker, Jay Didimo, David Bronson, Don Lombardi, Rob Wallace, and Colin Schofield. So enjoy part two. We sure love Freddie Gruber. And as you'll see from all these stories that we all have to share about just what an incredible person he was definitely a character, but above all that, he was just a beautiful, beautiful human. And he is loved and missed by all of us. So come along for the ride. Thanks for watching. Thanks for listening. And I'll see you on the other side.
Happening.
I think that's Freddie. He's having the last word, as usual.
Appetizing our event. What I was saying, and back in those days, my experience with Freddie was him breaking down systematically, as Bruce said he was, even in 10 years after that, Buddy's technique. As being younger than Buddy in New York and hanging out with him to some degree, having some fallout with him, which lasted about 15 years. They didn't talk to each other at all until Freddie came out here and Buddy started putting his new band together. But he had the foresight to see how you would use your body to follow and motivate the bounce of the stick and bring up some of the uniquenesses in Buddy's playing. And then the great thing that he had, which is what I think, you know, you guys I'm hearing is how he influenced your life, was just the musicianship of how that can all flow and make you be a creative person and be, you know, the legendary drummers that you are today. Totally unique person at every level of his life. I've got about a 2-hour interview with him that's up on the website, on the Drum Channel website, where I kind of tried to reminisce through some of the stories that I'd heard that had happened to him personally, and then some of his experiences with Buddy too. But nobody ever like him before. Nobody ever like him coming up again. I'll unmute, have somebody jump in there.
None of a kind, right? None of a kind.
Yeah. One in a row, as Adam said.
I wanted to respond to what Steve said about the system factor. Yes, he had a system, but he was tapped in. He wanted to get those mechanics together so that he could draw you into what you needed to do musically. Because like as a kid, I knew kind of what I wanted to do, and he just prodded you along and led you there. There was one point, this kind of taps into Adam. I was about maybe 19 or 20, and I was talking about, my brother's starting to play guitar, and I really want to, you know, work with him, and we want to get our jazz chops together. And he's listening, and it was interesting because there was nobody else there for some reason. And he looked at me quietly. He picked up John Abercrombie's Timeless record. He put it on the turntable, dropped the needle on the first track, which is and it's just burning Jack DeJohnette and Jan Hammer on B3. And about maybe 3 minutes into it, my head's going to blow up. And he looks at me and goes, "You think those guys are trying to make money?" And I go, what the hell? So anyway, fast forward 2006, I'm in Latvia doing this jazz festival with my brother. And I was the teacher of note for the week. It was a jazz camp. Adam was there playing with, I believe it was Gary Versace and John Abercrombie. And my brother knew John a little bit. And I had met Adam previous to that. So my brother says, Bruce, come on up and let's go say hi to Adam. I go, I don't know if he's going to remember me. I walk in and Adam was a gracious fellow, just, "Hey, Bruce, what's going on?" And I see John, he's kind of melting in the chair because he was tired from his travel. And I tell him the story about the John Abercrombie record. And he looked up at me kind of with a frowned brow and he goes, "Well, as a matter of fact, we were trying to make money." And I started laughing. So I go, like a few years later, I'm hanging with Freddie. I think it was that shot with Mark Shulman. And I'm trying to tell Freddie the story, but how, of course, Freddie could derail you. He could descramble your brain. It was NAMM show. You know, it's what do I say, sensory overload, and I'm trying to hold Freddie's attention. So I'm telling him about the story back in 79 when we're listening to that record. I'm telling him about Adam's story, John Abercrombie with Adam, and about the punchline, and Freddie's trying to derail me, and finally I finish up, and I go, and Freddie, so John Abercrombie looked up at me, and he said, as a matter of fact, we were trying to make money. And Freddie looks at me and goes, oh, back to the coda, huh?
Back to the coda.
Yes. Yeah. Funny guy, man. Funny guy. So, yeah. But he was really tapped into what I was looking for. And the element of that, mechanical breakdown stuff was crucial to put your body at ease so you could get into conceptually where you wanted to take it. And all the posture and gesture and the different positions. I mean, fantastic. I mean, that really.
So Bruce, you were an early student of his, obviously Dr. David was already playing. Yeah. Stephen was playing already.
Yeah. I was in 77. I was back in 77.
Somebody that was playing already, he was going to be more of an observer and find a missing puzzle to say, hey, you're holding the oar the wrong way for, making the boat go forward or. His techniques were observation, but also observation of body mechanics and mm-hmm. and how that all stood. So that's why you had possibly the system that he was drawing from.
Oh yeah, and once we went through that, we went on to a bunch. Where
he knew that somebody like David didn't. He knew how to play already, and Stephen didn't know how to play. He just wanted to show them missing pieces, maybe. Another thing that you overlook because you're already playing your gigs, you're speaking the language already. So it's like something that you don't want to put yourself, but Freddie being the way he is, he's going to be forward that way. He's going to, if you guys want to see a really cool video, when we were out one mm-hmm. night, cause we would go take these like 1 o'clock in the morning, go to the city from here in Jersey. I took a video of him on 42nd Street. He decides that these kids are serving ice cream. I guess it must have been around 12:30 at night or 12. And they were serving ice cream outside in this concession. And he takes two ice cream scoops and he starts playing drums with them. And it's on YouTube. I should try to see if I get it and you guys could show it. But you can see, man, his technique, even with ice cream scoops, were. It was like amazing. You go, okay, now I know I can see where he's coming from. But it's pretty amazing when you watch this video, it's just the end piece of him playing. They're rapping and he's playing rapping using the ice cream containers as drum set. And it's amazing. When you watch him play, you go, okay, there's the form. There's the whole thing. Just using two metal ice cream scoops, it's kind of crazy. So, I'll send it to you guys. And it's interesting to look at because it's everything we're talking about and what you're talking about, Bruce, with, sitting there and having that hang kind of thing where your hands are falling, into place. And
well, the one clip that Vinny was talking about is a personal clinic I had done with Freddie in Germany. We did 5 together, one in the States and 4 in Europe. And he'd always have me play because he would get sometimes wildly off topic, as we all know.
Yeah.
But on the one that I did with him in Germany, Jimmy Chapin was there. And I really tried to hold Freddie accountable to not get nuts and doing shtick. And he did get a little bit over the place, but the voice quality that he had let me know that he was somewhat relaxed and clear about what he was doing. And that's a clip I put up. That's the one that Vinny was talking about. I have more of that. And he was.
Wow.
That was pretty awesome just to watch him in that environment and kind of keep him down because I was at a few other clinics and they weren't good. They were wildly off topic. And
Well, I didn't want to insult anybody when compared themselves when I said, what were you two guys? I think it was coming from the perspective of being innovators because obviously Jimmy Chapin with his independent books. Mm-hmm. When I was a kid, I studied. My uncle was a drummer, played with Toscanini, Leonard Bernstein. So I grew up in a music family, and the guys my uncle told me to study with back in the 60s, he goes, you got to study with this guy, Jimmy Chapin, if you ever have a chance to. And I met Jimmy at the NAMM show was like the big, yearbook convention for any musician. We get to see each other and do what we have to do. But that's where I've met Freddie, and then we became friends from just he saw me. We were telling jokes at the Zildjian table, and he was sitting next to Dennis Chambers, and Dennis and I have been friends for quite some time. And he was like, "Who's this guy?" And typical Freddie, New York grovel, 52nd Street grovel. He came over by me. We became friends, and then he ended up he had a place over on Madison Ave here in the city with Cindy, and then he came over the house, and during the summer he would just stay over here. He just liked being at the he didn't want to be alone in the city, and then we had a room in the house, and we were just like, you know, you want to hang. So it was like having your uncle over. But then, you know, as he got older, he started getting really grovelly. He started getting very, not the nicest guy to hang with. Little did we know, if we had some pot around the house, probably would have curated his anxieties a little more. But,
yeah,
you know, it was like his brain was always going. He couldn't shut himself down. He was always thinking about stuff and the music. And I remember we went to the Vanguard one night, and he used to be able to go anywhere and they knew who he was. And the whole scene changed within itself. And, you know, it was like a lot of his friends were passing away. And he just said, goes, you know, I got nobody. I said, yeah, you do. You got all the drummers that are out there. They love, you know, show them stuff, teach them, do things. Yeah, we went to Freddie's birthday party with Roy Haynes. And, you know, Roy's still around, man. God bless him. You know, Al Foster, they're all around. And there's Ray in the back.
Yeah,
Ray, the guy in the back behind Roy Haynes. I think that's Ray. That I think he used to play on. I think he was on the name. You Bet Your Life. When
that's Ray Mosca.
Mosca.
Ray, yes.
Oh yeah.
Ray Mosca, and the tall gentleman is Bill Goodwin, and down
and
at the
Junior
bottom,
Mance.
Junior Mance. Right.
Junior Mance.
That was Freddie's birthday.
Yeah. Yeah. I was at that party. I was lucky enough to be there.
Hey, Adam.
I went
Adam.
To one a couple years Adam. Later. I went to Freddie's other party that he had.
Sorry,
he
was... Jay, great stories, man. I got to jump in though. I got to ask Adam, because I've never actually really talked to you, man, about your experiences with what was your time like with Freddie? I'm really curious. Actually, did you study with him actually, like in a study situation, or was it more the hang thing?
It was, I'd say, three quarters hang, one quarter lesson.
that sounds about right.
I met him initially at Mel Lewis's house.
Wow.
Mel was like a mentor, one of my New York fathers as such. And, you know, I pretty much came up. I was, you know, like monkey see, monkey do. I was fortunate to grow up around the New York area, so many great drummers were direct contact for me. Go to the Village Vanguard, sit next to Mel, Elvin, Roy, Tony, Jack, everybody. You know, that's kind of where I was from. It's like, oh, you watch them, you pay attention, you listen. And so then I meet Freddie, and I'd known all about his reputation. Oh, that's a wonderful photograph. Wow. So I met Freddie at Mel's, and I had a gig. So Mel and Freddie show up at the gig, and I'm feeling at this point, I'm kind of like up against the wall with something. And I've always tried to be very naturally oriented, and, you know, I'm always thinking about the flow and trying to get the smoothness and, well, try to let it more than make it. And what I had to say is with both you and Steve, Dave and Steve, you guys always were playing your ass off. But after you guys saw Freddie, it's like he put the grease on all your stuff. He just greased you up. And so everything was just flow freely. And it was wonderful to see guys that were as accomplished as you two go to that next level.
It was like finishing school, you know.
Right. It's like once you go to see, once you play with our Blakey, you're ready.
Yeah.
You know, once you go, you get that kind of, you get your degree. And so I said to Freddie, you know, I'm playing the gig, and then I see Freddie. I say, Freddie, I need some help. And his first thing he said to me was, it ain't broke, don't fix it. I said, basically, I basically almost said, you know, fuck you very much. You know, I'm up against the wall with something. I want to get my left hand more together. You know, my right hand, thank God, I got a nice groovelation with that baby playing the ride cymbal. You know, I think that's why I've been able to work.
Well, Adam, just to jump in for a second, Freddie said your right hand was a wonder. Adam's right hand. Oh, yeah. It's a wonder. Yeah. Yeah. You know, that's a quote. That's a quote.
Well, thank you very much. You know, I don't know what happened. It just kind of happened. Nice. Nurture and being around, seeing so many great players play. And, you know, like I said, monkey see, monkey do. These pictures are fantastic.
They're great. Yeah, thank you, guys. Right. Can I just jump in for 1 second? I want to make sure we get to David Bronson and Colin. But, Adam, I remember one of the years or the year you played at the Modern Drummer Festival. We all used to watch from backstage behind the curtain. You remember there was the curtain there behind the stage. I'm standing there next to Freddie. At one point, you came out and you're playing Brushes on a newspaper. Do you remember that? And then
I remember because Terry Bozzio had like the USS Enterprise book. Yes. The USS Bozzio was there.
Right.
Like 7 yeah. million drums. And I said to somebody that was there, I said, you know, man, we're not here because of all this. We're there because we know how to make music with people.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I said, I just go out there with a newspaper. And one of the guys said, okay, I dare you.
And you so did, I went, man.
But okay, then, go ahead.
No, but then you switched to sticks at some point, and you were playing just some crazy straight ahead shit. And Freddie was standing behind the curtain. You know, there's like an opening in the curtain where you could sort of, you know, the Rick Van Horn would yell if you were like in sight of the audience. He'd say, "Get out of here!" You know, they can see you. And Freddie's standing there, and he's like doing like karate moves to your playing. He's going, "Yeah, fuck, yeah, yeah. That's what I'm talking about, right there. That's it. That's it." Whoa! Ooh! Ah! Ooh! It was. He had to be there, but it was incredible. He was. It was Freddie. You know, and he had the hat, the Yankees hat, and the cigarette, unlit cigarette in his hand.
Did he help you with your left hand? What you went to him for?
Oh yeah. So I went to Freddie's. I was out in L.A. and I went to the house, and I'm sitting there. Excuse the dog. He wants me to mess with him. So. What happened was I'm at Freddie's house and he's in the kitchen making coffee and everything. And I'm playing and he hears me and I say, Freddie, come in here. I want you to see what I want to work on. And he says, you want to work on that right foot and you want to get that left hand together, right? And that made me realize the depth of how he can hear. And something that I've realized as I've gotten older, the people that play the best hear the best. And the other thing that I've kind of learned over time is I want to be intense when I play. I can't get tense. You want to be exciting. You can't get excited. Mm-hmm. And you got to have this yin yang thing going because you just want to let it come out. And, you know, the thing about Freddie was learning how to let it. And I don't have it together like, you know, Dave and Steve have this a lot more together. I could use some help, actually. So can we make an appointment?
Shut up.
But this is all stuff that just goes on with time. And, you know, also because I'm such a fan of the music, and I love the history. When Freddie would start to get off track and talk about somebody, I could get in there with him. And he'd go, oh, you know this guy? Or I'd mention somebody else. And then I could kind of get some New York tactics on him, too. So it was
nice.
He was something, man. He was really something. You know, he was on the scene. And I think, you know, because of his power of observation, and him being able to retain so much of guys that were on the scene when the whole bebop era was developing and things like that. And, you know, him hanging out with Philly and Klook and cats like that. You know, there's no substitute, I feel, to direct contact. You know, when you're in the room and you hear somebody, you feel it, or when you get to play with somebody you've heard a million times on a record, there's no substitute for that. As wonderful as YouTube is and the technology, it's like when you're in the room and you're there, that's something that it's totally irreplaceable, because you feel it in your whole body. And, you know, Freddie, I know people like Vinny was saying, a lot of people would say, oh, who is this crazy guy? And I'm thinking in my head, wait a minute. He's probably forgotten more shit than you will ever know. Okay? So just, you know, respect that. And I've seen it so much with the elders, you know, the elder musicians that are still with us. God bless them, you know? And I always cherish the opportunities when I can be around those people and the few that are still with us, you know? Yeah. And, I just have a lot of gratitude, and I feel that this is I'm just have a lot of gratitude, and to be with all you illustrious people who've been so inspiring to me along the way has been fantastic. And another thing, Steve, that somebody was saying to me after he was watching the Brush thing that we did together, he was going, man, maybe you could do a whole thing on just the right hand, different guys, because everybody plays the right hand different, you know, trying to get that ding-a-ling spang-a-ling with that ickety boom, you know, that whole thing.
that's great.
Well, your personality's in the music, Adam. Your personality is in the drumming.
Well, I think you play the way that you are.
That's
going to come out.
Let's turn it over to David Bronson, because I know David has a long history. You studied with Freddie.
Good to see you, man. Thank you for including me, Johnny.
Oh, Adam, of course. Yeah. Please stick around. Yeah. David, welcome. You know what, Colin, why don't you come on in here while we try to get David sorted out, just to keep things moving along here.
Absolutely.
I sort of shared that PASIC story as part of another story, but I would love
you. You missed the best part of it, though.
Yes.
Let me say for a second, Colin, before you get started. First of all, hi, good to see you. It's been a long time.
It's been a very long time.
I'm going to have to sneak out the door because I've got to be someplace at 1 o'clock.
Okay, Don.
I understand. It's the story of my life. But go ahead.
What a thrill to see all you guys, and what a legendary group we got here.
Don, you are the best.
A little bit, and then I'll slide out. Let's see what we got. Colin, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, the first thing I wanted to mention was I just want to acknowledge Ian Wallace again. I know, Steve, you know, you mentioned that it was Ian that introduced you to Freddie.
Yes.
And, you know, I think that was the case with a lot of people. You know, certainly from my perspective, you know, it was Ian who talked to me about Freddie, and it was Ian that started encouraging Freddie to go to the NAMM show and go to the PAS show and go to the Modern Drummer Festival, because, you know, a while back, Freddie, you wouldn't see Freddie at the NAMM show. But it was after when Ian started studying with Freddie, and I remember Ian, you know, good friend. I mean, I remember him saying, oh my God, just, you know, started studying with this amazing guy, Freddie Gruber. He's completely turned my world, you know, upside down. And it was Ian that really, I think, exposed Freddie to, like, you know, our generation, as it were. I think there were the older people that knew about him, but it was certainly Ian that from what I remember that brought him to the kind of to the foreground again. And I think it was from that how Neil Peart got to, you know, got connected with him.
Well, so, no, you're right on it. But I was the one that introduced Neil to Freddie.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, but I think it was because, you know, Freddie was being talked about at that time. And,
right.
And I know it was you that, you know, that
made the connection.
Opened that door. Yeah, yeah. As it were.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I mean, I think it was, you know, that was the kind of the end result of the fact that Freddie was now going to the NAMM shows and going to the Modern Drummer Festival, et cetera, and, you know, we began to see him everywhere. I think the other thing that I wanted to mention was that, you know, Freddie's wisdom extended, you know, way beyond just the drums. And, you know, Steve, I don't know whether you remember this. There was one evening we had dinner. It was just the four of us. It was Freddie, yourself, Johnny D, and me. And it was at the Pasek in Nashville. It was just the four of us had dinner with, and Freddie, you know, gave us his history of the world. And you know, the three of us didn't say a thing.
No, just one month. It was the history of the universe.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was
deep, there deep was, shit.
It started with this amoeba. And then the amoeba said, I'm bored. Let's split.
Yes.
But, I mean, I'll never forget that dinner. And, you know, we were kind of like speechless by the end of it. And I remember, you know, walking out of the restaurant sort of questioning my own existence. It was, you know, life, the universe, and the answer to life, the universe, and everything. So, you know, that I think that's the other thing people need to understand about Freddie. His wisdom was beyond just the drum.
Yeah.
I mean, he laid so much heavy stuff on me, you know, about life and living and everything. He was, you know, life-changing, really, getting to know him. Then quickly, just that PAS story, John. I mean, just so that people understand, you know, at that time, yes, Freddie had started, you know, his fame had spread because of the Neil Peart and Steve Smith connection, et cetera, et cetera. And I just remember it well. I think it was probably his first clinic that he ever did at Pasek. I don't think he'd been there before. And he had, you know, and the room was packed. I mean, it was standing room only for Freddie's clinic. And I remember there's all these, like, students from Berkeley you know, North Texas State, and they're all at the front row, you know, they've got their notepads and their pencils ready and, you know, to learn from the guru. And, you know, as we said, sometimes Freddie should be very, very, very succinct and sum up very complex things in a couple of sentences. But then there was other times where, you know, I think he was so, it was so important to him to be absolutely correct in the information that he was passing on, that he would say something and then he would kind of have to qualify what it was that he was saying. And then he'd be qualifying the qualifier and qualifying the qualifier. So he started, you know, his whole clinic at Pasek, he'd start talking about something, but within seconds, he was, you know, like 15 to 20 places removed from what he was talking about initially. And so, you know, you had all these young students, you know, sitting around and they're like, what is going on? I mean, they were obviously finding it very difficult to follow, but then Lenny D'Annunzio and Armin Zilt, and they were both sitting in the front row. And as it got, you know, started getting longer and longer, and you know, again, I mean, Freddie was just rambling at this point. And Armin starts, Freddie, play something. Sit down and play the drums. You know, play something. And then, and Lenny starts getting mad with him. He's like, play something, Freddie, pick up the sticks, play something, sit and play the drum. And it just turned into this, you know, chaotic scene with all these confused drum students and Lenny and Armin yelling at Freddie. And it was, you know, it was a crazy time.
Colin, you know, if you recall when Freddie was doing that, you would see him look back at the drums and he'd go like, yeah. And then he would continue his thought, but he was just like looking at the drums and he'd kind of just throw his hand back there like, nah, not now. I'm busy doing something else.
Yeah, exactly. It was, you know, I mean, he was deep in the zone. Everything that he was, if you could follow him and, and, you know, keep up with him, obviously, you know, whatever he was saying was, you know, there was no wasted words, but it was, if you didn't know how to listen to Freddie, then it could be very, you know, it could be very confusing.
Yeah. And, you know, Kasich was not the right venue for him.
You know, in addition to it, everybody, and I'm thrilled to just be a fly on the wall, and it's bringing back so many memories for me of, the, you know, making me think about things of Freddie. You know, I miss him. I used to get the Sunday night call at like 9:30, you know, East Coast time. It was like the phone would ring. I'd be watching The Sopranos, and my wife would say, you know who, it's your call, it's Freddie, you know, go get the phone. But his cultural... another aspect that I just wanted to touch on, and I'm sure, you know, you guys that knew him a long time have heard it, but his cultural history and the stories that he, you know, the people he knew in New York, Allen Ginsberg, I don't know if you guys have heard those stories, you know, Marilyn Monroe.
Lenny Bruce, I think.
Bruce, yeah. He would talk about going up to Harlem to these late night, you know, he called them these, you know, late night jams after everyone's gig was over, and Marlon Brando would be playing bongos, you know, and I did, you know, sometimes, you know, some of the Freddie stories, you'd say.
Steve McQueen, he would hang out with Steve McQueen.
Charlie Parker. Malcolm X.
Malcolm X.
Called them. Yeah.
Animal Red.
You know. His whole New York cultural thing used to, you know, and you'd kind of have to, you know, sift through all the other stuff. But then he'd talk about, you know, yeah, we were at Allen Ginsberg apartment and I needed a place to crash for a few months. And I lived with Allen Ginsberg. It's like, are you kidding me, Freddie? I mean, sometimes it would be, you know, it was, you know, like, oh, I'm hanging out with John Kennedy tonight. You know, we're going to go out and, you know, listen to jazz. But that didn't happen. But I mean, he would drop these names and he'd sort of have the cigarette and he'd be going like that with the cigarette, you know. You know, I just wanted to insert about that other part of his right. personality and humanity, really, you know.
There's really. Actually,
well, that was his thing. He would say, you know, it's about the hang. He would say, you know, being there is part of it. You know, it's like go, and that's why the YouTube thing doesn't work. And you know, social media does like this because we get to see each other from all over the place. But it's still not like that hanging in a room together and, you know, telling jokes or kidding around and that vibe that you get in the air. You know, it's like it's a different
having thing. A few pops for the body.
And his memory was incredible. You know, he would remember such detail about those things that he, you know, talk about the old New York in the 50s, you know, 40s, Dave Tough, you know.
Yeah, I wish back when we were hanging, this is like, I guess, late 80s, early 2000, they really didn't have the phone cameras. And I had this little crappy, it was a regular camera, but it shot video also. And I got a few things with him walking around the city at night. But one night he goes, you see that building right here? Right up there, that's where Miles had Wayne Shorter and Herbie Hancock and a young Tony Williams. And I went there. Now, I don't know if you knew this, but Freddie would get pop for everybody, get drugs for some guys. So he goes, I go up there to go bring some junk to Miles. And I'm standing with Miles, and he goes, they're listening to Tony Williams. And he goes, wow, Miles, this drummer's incredible. And Miles said to him, yeah, Freddie, I this kid wanted to come and play with the band. I told him to get away, get out of here. He goes, man, was I wrong, you know, not having this kid play. And that was like with Tony Williams.
Wow.
So he was like explaining, he goes, that's the building that they were rehearsing in. And then we'd go to the Brill Building. He would tell stories. I got a videos of some of that stuff, but it didn't take that. The videos weren't, you know, as like what we have with the phones today. But
right.
I tried to capture something out of him. I wish I got the one when I stayed at his house. I'm sleeping in his room, and Neil Peart just had left. And he goes, he just left. I go, who? He goes, Neil just left. He came in on his motorcycle. He's driving around cross country. It's like, oh, shit. I wanted to talk to him. But he goes, you're going to stay here. Now you stay with me. I said, well, I'll get a hotel, you know, whatever. I'm here. I played a gig in Vegas. I flew in and I said, okay, I'll go and I'll be here with you. So I hung out with him and I'm sleeping, whatever sleep I can get when Freddie seems to stay up 24 hours a day. And all of a sudden I hear, oh, ah, shit. Oh, boom. And it's him walking in the room. It's pitch black. All of a sudden a flashlight goes on. It's in my face. And he goes, it's really good having you here, man. I love it. And the light goes off. And then I hear him stumble back outside, not keeping the light on. So I hear him banging into things to walk out of the room. But then I wake up that morning. I hear a drum set being played really slow, like a blues thing. And I walk in the room. He had the back room with the clothes and the DW kit. He's sitting in boxer shorts, nothing else, pair of boxer shorts. Must have got about an hour of sleep. And he's playing this ride pattern. Ding, ding, da-ding, ding, da-ding. And the hi-hat's going. So I go, what are you doing? He goes, I heard this cat play this group, and I'm still trying to get the timing to be like that. He goes, the hardest thing is to play really slow and have that time. He goes, I'm still trying to get that feel down that this guy had. So, I mean, he was forever thinking from the minute he got up of what drums and what timing was and feel and everything else going. But he was a character. But I'll never get that visual of this Freddie Gruber in his boxer shorts sitting. But then again, he would be down here. I'd come home from a gig and hear my drum set being played because he was down here and he wanted to play. So it was good to see. I wish I had video of that stuff. And I also have Jimmy Chapin stayed here. And then somewhere I have an audio tape of him talking about all his stuff too. So I got to drag that and get it to you, Rob. But, you know, those are the guys that created a lot of crazy stuff. Yeah, Dave.
I'm sorry, I got to jump out. But I wanted to say how great it was to see you all and to hang with you and hear these stories. And so beautiful, man. It's really great. I just want to add one thing before I jump that Freddie imparted on me that I feel, you know, was probably, you know, in a nutshell, the biggest help and the biggest kind of profound realization for me was, and Johnny and Jay and you guys have all been kind of, you know, doing the impersonation of him, you know, ooh, ah, you know, and, ah, yeah, you know, and that yeah, whole yeah. thing, you know, and when I would study with him, you know, of course, a lot of it was the technical thing, the approach, the fluidity, the, you know, and, you know, laws of physics and all the natural stuff and the mechanics, right? But his main thing that he was always stressing was the feel. And it was always about getting to, and I'll never forget when he said this, he goes, if I can't shake my ass and stomp my foot to it, it doesn't mean anything, you know? And that was planted in me. And he showed me one thing with the jazz thing, you know, because it's all about the space. We all know that. It's not about the notes. It's what you do in between them that makes the feel happen, right? So he showed me this thing, which I've later, I guess, has become the reverse molar, right? To come over the back of the, you know, to let the stick droop over the front of the stick, you know, before two and four in the swing pattern. And I think, Jay, what you're talking about with that real slow quarter note thing, it was one of the bases for one of the patterns, and it was very slow swing, you know, and it was just the ride pattern in both the right and the left hand, you know, a little molar action with the left and the reverse molar with this one and the hi-hat on two and four, and the bass drum would be one, two, three, two. Three.
Exactly that. Right? Yep.
You know, and it was that exercise. And I couldn't, we play it slow, 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 slow. And it was at that moment that I understood how to actually play a slow triplet feel. I had been struggling my entire life as to, like, what do I do with this hand between, you know, one, that's at a slow tempo, between one and two is an eternity, you know? So yeah. It was one of the things that really kind of stayed with me, was that how important, and that it was really all about the motion of the space, you know, and that I think that's probably one of the things that helped me the most. So, you know, when you put it into mechanical terms of Muller or whatever the flow is, or whatever the mechanic and the movement, you know, the end of the day is like, how does it feel, and where is the placement of the notes? And it's all about the spatial stuff. But, you know, so that for me changed everything as to how I actually played and felt music, because coming up in the 80s with the drum machines and trying to get into the studios, man, I mean, I was focused at very cerebral playing, you know, counting, trying to actually sound like a drum machine at times to get the work right. So, you know, it all changed when the cerebral thing stops, when you stop thinking and you actually let a natural motion dictate and understand that, hey, if the motion is consistent in space, you start dictating where the feel is based on how much space you allow to happen between the notes. That was probably the most profound thing I got out of. I mean, I was with Freddie off and on for a few years. I got to say that thing changed me, you know, for life. That was like a life changing, you know, and it wasn't just about the technique, you know, it was about the fact that I could actually, for once, feel the music that I wanted to play while I was playing it, instead of when I was listening to it, you know, to get that emotional content. And that was for me, like, you know, it was just huge. More than
like an epiphany, you know, when you find out these.
It was an epiphany.
Dizzy Gillespie once said, the space is where the swing is.
Yeah, absolutely.
But
yeah.
Dave, let's.
We all have to believe that as much as the sound. What gives our sound its value? The space. Yep. What gives the space the value? The sound. And the drama that can be created through the space.
Yeah.
Well, let me just.
Really well said, Dave.
A little more, because he had me play that same thing. But here's the technical explanation, is that with a drumstick, you only hear half of the complete motion. So if you think about it, like I think he explained this to me, or I just got it. If you think about a tambourine or a shaker, you hear both sides of the motion.
Right.
You know, tambourine or shaker. Mm-hmm. And with the stick, if like you're saying, if time and space is equal, if you move the correct amount of space, the time's going to be consistent. And this side of the beat here, you know, we touch the cymbal.
It's just as important as that one.
Here. And we move this way. That we're not hearing that, but it's as important as this side. If you could hear both sides, you'd be in perfect time if you hear both sides. And that's that space that you're talking about. It's the side we don't hear. And I think he said to me, you only hear half the motion. You're not hearing this other half.
Yeah,
but it's vitally important as the side you hear.
That's some vital information there, Steve.
It is.
Oh, Freddie would point out that
with some advertisement to go along with it.
I love it.
Yeah, but you know, it's like a conversation. We're having a conversation, and basically, this is improvisation, because it's a thought. We're having a conversation over a concept, and that conversation is then elaborated through, you know, words that we use to explain that situation. So Gruber's thing too is like the concept of, you know, you're having a conversation using your drum set as the conversation. If it's soloing, it's certainly that left to right kind of conversation of a concept idea falling into the next concept of another idea. And the thing that's the technical aspect is really knowing, I guess, more words and how to use them, but the technical aspect would be somebody. I've had students that played great. They kind of just playing, they would actually have a conversation using the drums. So, you know, it's kind of, you know, fine tuning it as you go along and getting it down. So,
Just wanted to embellish on what you said, Steve, because Freddie would do that with that space value and just talk about this upstroke being the middle beat of the triplet.
Yeah.
Point that out, hit your stick, and get you to feel the middle beat of the triplet on the way up. You come off on the one, you'd feel the swing, and he wanted that swing feel to be so regulated and so natural to what it was, so that you did feel it, and it made time. All that motion makes time just feel so easily accessed once you get the movement of it. But the detail of which he would do, and a little kicks in the side with his elbow to get you to see how that worked was fantastic.
And some night we'd hold the stick above, right, and you'd hear this, and then you'd hear that. You'd hear both sides of the motion.
Hey guys, I want to take one more pass at having David Bronson just say a few words as we sort of wind down here.
Guys, I'm Johnny. Sorry to interrupt. I got to go. I'm a little late for an appointment here, so I got to run. Guys, I love y'all.
It's great to see you. Thank you. Take care, man.
Thanks, Dave.
David, I may be in St. Louis playing with a band, so I want to see if I could.
All right.
I'm playing with Nectar.
All right. Let me know.
Nectar from the 70s.
Let me know, Dre.
Dig it. Dave, thanks for having us so long. Thank you so much, Dave.
Take care, gentlemen.
See you soon,
Dave.
All right. See you, guys.
See you, buddy. All right.
Okay.
All right, David Bronson, let's see if we can
little bit. I'll tell you how I met Freddie Gruber. It was in 1978, and I was looking for a drum teacher. And in 1978, you just called people. And I called Joe Picaro. Back then they had answering services. And Joe called back. He said, "I'm too busy." He said, "Try Harvey Mason." I called Harvey. Harvey called back. He said, "I'm too busy." At the same time, I had called Shelly Mann. Shelly called me back. And he said, "I'm too busy." He said, "Call this guy Freddie Gruber." I said, "Who's Freddie Gruber?" And he said, "I don't know. Call him up." So I called Freddie up. Freddie called back. And I said, "Do you teach?" Freddie said, "Yeah." So he said, "Come on out to the house." And he was still living on the Etiwanda house at that time. And it was at like 1 o'clock on a Monday. I went over there, knocked on the door. He opened the door. He was in his tidy whitey underwear. He had one of those long, very long cords to his phone. And he answered the door and he said, "Come on in." So we go in, I sit down, it takes a couple hours to get a lesson out of him. And he did the basic thing. And, you know, he would do that and build pieces on. So fast forward, he was a good friend and a teacher for about 33 more years. And I lived with him the last 3 months of his life in 2011.
Wow.
And by that point, his house was nonstop. All the guys were coming over and calling, and I'm getting kind of jaded to it. And I would sit there on the couch. And then one day Jim Keltner calls me. He says, "I think I'll come over Sunday." And I said, "I will be here," because at that point in my life, I idolized Jim Keltner and Jim Gordon. And so anyway, I was there and we had a nice visit. And Neil Peart was there a lot also. It was kind of like Groundhog Day. Every day we'd get up, Freddie wasn't teaching anymore. He was pretty tired. He had renal failure. All he wanted to do was go up to Panda Express and get some food and sit there and eat it. So that's what we'd do. We'd go there. Then we'd go to the 7-Eleven. He'd get an ice cream. Then we'd go to Gelson's. He'd get little things of food. Sometimes hit Frankie. And then go back. Well, Neil Peart calls one day and he says, "How you doing?" I said, "I think I'm going to slit my wrists if I have to sit there another day." He goes, "Oh, I'm coming over." So we went up to Panda Express, and Neil Peart shows up with a bag of In-N-Out burgers and a bottle of scotch. And he and I drank the scotch and ate the In-N-Out burgers, and Fred's looking at us. It was a lovely summer, and we got to spend a lot of time together. And he was a wonderful, wonderful man. He was a genius teacher. He could get you to do things. He could take the training wheels off. You know, I was an okay drummer, not a great drummer, but he elevated me and got me up to where I was grooving well. My hands were pretty good, and I went and got a good gig, and I did that gig for 25 years. And that was my life with Freddie. He was a lovely, lovely man. He was great.
And that was the Righteous Brothers, David, right? You played with them?
Yes.
Yeah. What a great gig. Yeah. Can I just add that, you know, whenever I would talk to Freddie, he would always speak. He loved everybody, but he would always talk about my student, David Bronson. And then I met you sometime maybe in the 90s. I think we met at a NAMM show or something. And I just remember he, bless his heart, Freddie would tell me about you like it was the first time he ever mentioned you when not remembering that we had talked about you last time or something, but you meant a lot to him. You know, I know that. As many people here did, but he used to talk about how important you were as a friend and as a person besides being a student.
If he liked you, he was on your side.
I got
that gig taking care of him that last summer because he was full of bullshit and I could put up with it. It didn't bother me at all. And we just hung out. I was still living in Las Vegas. I was having trouble with a girlfriend at the time. And he would call me every night and go, "What's going on with that broad? How are you doing? You okay?"
He I agree though. He was so supportive of me, and he was, yeah. It's like when you pass the test with him, he was a loyal friend all the way through.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah.
Yep.
So I just wanted to say, I got to go too. My wife is really, like I told her, this would probably be about an hour. And I think we're going on 2.5, something like that.
Right.
But, yeah. But it just reminds me of Freddie. That's the way life with Freddie was. It just was, could be anything, time-wise or anything. And, Bronson, yeah, he loved you, man, so much. The time that I spent with him, I always just wanted to ask him about what was Roy Haynes really like? It was, and Elvin, and we're talking about Adam's right hand. I mean, this guy as a kid, right, probably a younger man, he's in New York City. He's able to watch up close Elvin Jones' right hand, which messed me up forever when I went from Shelley to Elvin, which is ridiculous, but that happened to me like that. It happened just like that. Shelley was my biggest hero. And then I heard a record with Elvin on it. And it was nothing to do with the Coltrane era. And then later, anyway, that's a long story, but the whole thing was that I loved talking with Freddie about this stuff, because every time I would mention something or somebody, he knew them and he had a story about them. And so and the other thing that's good about today is listening to Dave Weckl and Vinnie Colaiuta and Steve Smith, three of, there's a bunch of them out there, but those are the three that I know really well, and they're playing, and it's astonishing type playing of drums, and to hear them talk about Freddie, and how he affected their playing is, it's great for me because I really didn't know that. I actually did not know that. I've known Vinny a long time, I've known Dave a long time, and Steve, but I didn't realize how much he affected their playing. For me personally, I remember him saying a lot of stuff like, I loved the, when they said, get out of the way, he would always say stuff like that. And, what I remember is, I remember the floating stick, the floating thing and the backwards thing, playing with the back end of the stick coming down rather than always forward. It was something like that. I can't be as eloquent in speaking about the teaching thing as you guys, but what I got from that was that, yeah, I need to pay attention and remember that the sticks should work for me. I shouldn't have to be working for them, making them do things. And that whole concept was beautiful. And another thing, is Don Lombardi still here? I've lost my...
No, Don had to leave.
Oh, yeah, Don had to leave. Well, if any of y'all think of Don Lombardi as just the guy that owns the drum shop, you should hear him sit at a pad sometime. I've never actually heard him play on the drums, not since when we were both kids playing bar mitzvahs and weddings. But you sit and you listen to Don Lombardi today play on a pad, and you'll see some amazing chops, and that's Freddie.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes me, every time I see that, or something like that, or like Dave and you guys, I think I want to kick myself for not having paid a little more attention and kind of put more effort into it. But I got really busy, you know, I got really busy early on.
A little bit,
so
Jim, a little bit.
That's my excuse, but Freddie did affect me, and that's what's beautiful about today, to see how much effect he had on all you guys, because you're all bad, and you know, we all bring to the table us. Somebody said that a minute ago when we were talking about Adam. We play who we are, our personalities, who we are as people. That is our music. That's what it is. It can't be anything else. And I love that. And I love being able to appreciate all of us, you know, everything that we do. And I used to have those kind of conversations with Freddie. And Freddie, I think that this may have come from Freddie, as a matter of fact. He used to talk about that a lot. You play who you are and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, God bless Freddie. God bless all of you. I love you a lot. I'm going to go now. So,
thank you for being here, Jim.
That was the perfect summary. You put the period on the end of this whole tribute to Freddie.
This is why Jim Keltner is the Jedi Master. He's earned that. He's earned that title. He is a national treasure. He has a birthday coming up, and we love you so much, Jim.
Johnny, thank you, man. Thank you for providing all these kinds of things. You do it better than anybody, bro.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you.
All right. As Freddie would say, see you in a minute.
See you in a minute. All right.
See you, Jim.
All right.
Jim, it's humbling to be in your presence, Jim. It's really humbling.
It really is. Thank
you. I love you guys so much.
Some Keltner mojo to get me through the rest of the week now. So thank you, Jim.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I got the news.
Guys, I think we should end on the highest note possible here with those words from Jim Keltner.
Yeah.
And, I want to thank everybody for being here. And were there any final words before we say goodbye to the folks watching at home? They've been paid.
Freddie Gruber quotes. I'll eat when I want to eat. I sleep when I want have to sleep.
He got that from Helen Reddy. It was eat when you're hungry, sleep when you're tired.
Yeah, well, we had it, you know, that's what his quotes were. Eat when I want to eat.
Yeah.
That's what he revised it. And see you in a minute also. So
of course.
And let me be brief.
Let me be brief.
I'll be brief.
Never happened. Let me be brief, yes.
What up, my favorite
show? Like this program.
Well, Colin, what are you going to say, Colin? The time zone here. Nice.
I was just going to say, when you were talking about Adam at the PAS show, And, you know, it was doing, oh no, Modern Drummer Festival with, Terry Bozzio. And that was the first time, you know, Terry was doing his solo, you know, drum performance. And that was the first time that, that Freddie had, he'd ever seen Terry. And, you know, and again, we were all standing behind the curtain at the back. And Freddie leans over to me and says, "He's the love child of Igor Stravinsky and a Watusi tribes woman."
Yeah, right? But yeah, it's right, though. That's true. Right? I mean, oh, my God. Yeah, he had, that's, I know, good. And that would just come to him instantly. Those yeah. lines, Colin. Yeah, he would just go.
Classic.
But, man, he could figure the room out in a flash, you know. It just, just one last thing too. I Rob, I remember at the Hudson or Drummers Collective 25th anniversary bash that you guys threw. Remember that big party at the Manhattan Center? Was that where it was?
2002. Yeah.
2002. That's right. Well. Yeah. And I remember going backstage and there's Lenny and Freddie chatting with Charlie Callis, and I'm starstruck seeing Charlie Callis, and I kind of happen to wander over, and Freddie says something like, "Wait, you want to meet him?" Yeah. And, you know, it's like, it's just Charlie Callis, you know, just kind of like very mad. I'm like, it's Charlie Callis. I've been watching him. So anyway, I remember he was very kind. He introduced me and Lenny as well, and said, you know, it's John, he works for Zildjian, and, you know, and Charlie kind of, you know, it was weird to see him out of character, like this real serious kind of, they were talking drums, you know, and he's very like serious, and I was waiting for him to go off, you know, do one of his things. But anyway, Freddie had the cred, you know. He like somebody said, you know, he hung with these guys and they all loved him and respected him. But just like I love and respect you guys, and I want to thank everybody for being here today. This has been amazing.
Thank you, Bruce.
Yeah, big hand. Yeah, thanks to Bruce John, for coming up thank with you, this Rob. Idea.
Thank you guys.
The last man standing.
You know, I got to just say, this was my list. I mean, everybody showed up that I was thinking about when Rob and I talked originally.
Amazing.
So it's awesome. Awesome.
Really.
Well, thanks for the invitation. Much appreciated. Yeah.
Bruce Becker.
Grateful to Steve Smith. Here.
Steve Smith, Rob Wallace, Adam Nussbaum, Colin Schofield, Jay Didimo, Vinny, Dave Weckl, Don Lombardi, and the Jedi Master, Jim Keltner. I think that's and Mark Shulman also was here. Yep. And David Bronson. Yes. So that's the complete all list. Right. Thank you guys. I'm going to end the stream. Bye-bye, hang out for one everyone. Second. Thanks for watching, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, Danny D.
See you guys.
Love to you all.
All right. Thanks, you guys. Ciao. That was fantastic. Hey, everybody, John DeChristopher here, and I want to thank you for watching and listening to Live from My Drum Room. I started this show in April of 2020, and it's now 4 years and almost 200 episodes later, and I'm excited to tell you about my new Live from My Drum Room t-shirts. In fact, I'm wearing one right now. Made of 60% cotton, 40% polyester, a really soft cotton blend. I'm wearing a size medium, and you can have yours for $25, including shipping, in the contiguous U.S. I will give you my Venmo information, which I'll also include in the description. There's my Venmo information, and you can email me at livefrommydrumroom@gmail.com with any questions, and that will also be in the description. So get your shirt while they last. They're available in extra small to double XL. I do have limited quantities of the extra smalls and the double XLs, but plenty of everything else. So once again, thanks for watching. Thanks for listening. Thanks for subscribing. And don't forget to pick up your Live from My Drum Room t-shirt. See you soon. And remember, no drummers are harmed on any show. All right, well, that's my show. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, give it a like, leave me a comment. Don't forget to subscribe to my YouTube channel if you haven't done that already. And the podcast is available on all the podcast platforms, so download it. And remember, no drummers are ever harmed on Live from My Drum Room or Track Talk. And drummers, when in doubt, leave it out. All right. Again, thanks for watching. Thanks for listening. And I'll see you again real soon. See ya.